Who do you think is the most well-known person in the world today? Who is the most well-known person in the last 200 years? And who is the most well-known person of all time? Almost 3 billion people in the world today worship Jesus Christ. Who do you think he is? The evidence shows if Jesus wasn't God, then he deserved an Oscar.
Welcome to our program. I'm glad that you joined me. We started this series by addressing those who are atheists or agnostics, and then laid a factual foundation that shows that Christianity is totally based on a real man who lived in real history by the name of Jesus Christ. Now today I want to examine the testimony of both friends and enemies of Jesus to see if they thought he was unique. That is, that he never sinned once and he lived a perfect life. And if they did, what does that mean to us? I hope that I can share with you some things about Jesus that you may never have thought about before. Come with me now to Boca Raton, Florida, where I was presenting this evidence at a conference. Now, before we go on to the next part, we're looking at the claims of Jesus Christ, and then we're going to look at the character of Jesus Christ, to look at the information and see, is he unique in any way? Is he unique in his claims? Is he unique in his character? Is he unique in his works, his miracles, which will bring us into the resurrection of the dead? And then I'm going to say, draw a line on this evidence and tell me, who do you think that Jesus Christ is? But in finishing up the fact of Jesus' claims, one of the questions that people ought to ask, did the enemies of Jesus Christ understand that he was claiming to be God? Obviously, if the disciples said that he was God, they could be padding the case. But did his enemies say that? If you go into a courtroom and you get the other side to admit what you want them to admit, then you've won the case. And the question is there any evidence that the opposition, those that were opposed to him, heard him say that he was the Son of God or God himself? But the answer is yes to the question, did they understand it that way? In Matthew chapter 27, 41 through 43, we find these words. Likewise, also the chief priests mocking him, he was on the cross, with the scribes and the elders. Now you have the hierarchy of Israel before the cross. Jesus is on the cross. And they're looking up at him, and they said, he, that's Jesus, trusted in God. Let God deliver him now, if he will have him. And then look what it says. This is the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders. For he, that's Jesus, said, I am the Son of God. Well, where did they get that? They must have heard Jesus making those statements. And they taunted him with his own statements while he was on the cross. Now, sure, they didn't think he was God, but the very fact that they would use this against him when he's on the cross, he must have said it, right? Then take a look at John chapter 5, verse 18. It's another place. And there the scripture says, therefore the Jews sought the more to kill Jesus because he not only had broken the Sabbath, but said also that God was his Father. Then look at the next words. Making himself equal with God. And so the Jewish leaders understood him to be saying that he was God. This is evidence that's on the table. Now, we have the claims of Jesus Christ that he claims to be God. Now we want to turn and we're going to go to point two, and that is the character of Jesus Christ. What was he like? This guy that claims to be God, what was he like when you met him? Okay? Well, let's start off with this. If you ever sat down with a friend and asked them this question over a cup of coffee, hey, let's get together. Let's talk about today what Jesus did wrong. How long would your conversation be? Be a real short conversation, wouldn't it? All right, now turn that around. Let's say that we're with your family, okay? Let's say it's Thanksgiving or Christmas. You got all the relatives, all the kids there. And Dad, you stand up and you say, now gather around, friends. I got to ask you a question. I'd like to know, can anybody here remember one thing that I've done wrong? Would any guy here like to try and say that? I can see the kids that would, if you said, you know, write them down and hand them in, the kids would say, hey, Dad, could I have more paper? I mean, none of us would say something like that. But Jesus made that exact statement to his enemies, not to the guys that loved him. He asked his enemies, which one of you can convict me of one sin? And nobody could say anything. Jesus possessed a keen moral judgment, if you want, a spiritual radar is what I call it. When he looked at other people, it wasn't that he didn't know the difference between right and wrong. Do you remember when he looked at the religious leaders of his own day? He saw their sins and was not afraid to say something about it, was he? He called them whitewashed sepulchers. They looked pretty on the outside. Inside, they were full of dead men's bones. He called them snakes in the grass. He told them they were proud. He told them they were hypocrites. I mean, that's pretty strong language. You say that to the pastor, right? You're a snake in the grass. So the fact is that Jesus, when he looked at other people, he had this moral radar that went right out there, and he was not afraid to say something. Even his own disciples, when they came and said, look, Jesus, got this little request. One of us would like to sit on your left hand, the other one on the right hand, when you come into power. Just a little request. Jesus said, this thing of one-upmanship, it shall not be so among you. But the one that wants to be the greatest, you need to be the servant. And if you want to be the very top of the totem pole, you be the slave. You do anything. So Jesus was not afraid to rebuke his own disciples or the religious leaders of his own day. He had the spiritual radar that went out that didn't quit. And yet, when he focused that spiritual radar on himself, you never hear him say that he did one sin. You never hear one prayer of his confessing to the Father that I've sinned. You never hear any of the disciples say, he sinned, he blew it over here. Now that in itself is really remarkable. Do you know anybody else like that? No, we can't think of one person in history that has those kinds of qualifications. We can't think of one person in history except Jesus Christ. He must be unique. Let me see if I can give you a better example. In church history itself, there have been many great men, all right? There was Augustine. And Augustine, of course, in his memoirs and in his confessions, actually, wrote about how he became a Christian, and then as he grew closer with God, he started to talk about the sins of his life. And the closer that he got to God, the more he confessed his own sins. The same was true about Luther and Calvin and Wesley, and as you go up through Finney, and you get to our day of Billy Graham, and so on. All of the men that have served God in a great way, the closer they get to God, the more they confess their own sins, right? Now think about this. If that's true, what about Jesus? The skeptics say he was not God. He was just a great man, and he got closer to God than anybody else. Well, if he got closer to God than anybody else, and the standard practice down through church history has been that the closer these men have gotten to God, the more they see their own sin, then where is it that Jesus confesses his own sin? Why don't we see it? He breaks the mold. What did his friends say about Jesus? Obviously, if you want to find out about a man, you better ask his friends, ask his family. The disciples lived with him, ate with him, slept with him for 3 solid years at least. They knew everything about the guy. What did they say about him? Did they see any slip-ups? Peter described Jesus as a lamb without spot or blemish. He states, Jesus committed no sin, in fact, no guile, no deceit was even found on his lips. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 22. The Apostle John said, in Christ there is no sin. And he said that in the same book where he said, all men are sinners, and if we say we have no sin, we are liars ourselves and make God a liar too. The Apostle Paul said, Jesus knew no sin. Rather, he was holy. He was blameless. He was unstained. He was separate from sinners. 2 Corinthians 5:21 and Hebrews 7:26. He said Jesus was in every respect, what? Tempted as we are, yet without sin. That's what the record shows. His character was absolutely unique. So what do you do with this man? Who was he?
When we return, why is the resurrection of Jesus the only thing that accounts for the conversion of James, Jesus' skeptical brother, and Saul of Tarsus, a man who went about killing Christians?
Is Jesus unique? Yes, he is. Absolutely unique. But then there's something else about him. Remember, he said that he was the light of the world. What would you think it would be like to be around the light of the world? Anybody that says they're the greatest, you kind of say, let's take five steps back and let's take a look at this real carefully. You would assume they would be proud. You would think they would be a snob. What do you think it would be like to be around the guy that says, I'm coming back at the end of the world. I'm going to determine the eternal destiny of every man, woman, and child that's ever lived. What do you think it would be like? Isn't it amazing that the children loved to be with him, that the sinners congregated around him, that the people thought he was their friend? And it's all true. That's how they looked at Jesus.
The record says he had no touch of self-importance. He was not pompous. He was not proud. He was the Lord of all. But what did he do? He washed the feet of the disciples. He said he was going to judge the world. But he could take the little children in his arms. He made friends with simple fishermen and publicans, and he touched the outcasts, the lepers. At the end of his life, when he was put on the cross, and as the cruel spikes were driven through his hands, he prayed, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. That's what the record shows. His character was absolutely unique. So what do you do with this man? Who was he? But then we get down to his miracles. His miracles. You know, when you read the miracles in the New Testament, you don't get the idea that they are like a magician pulling a rabbit out of the hat. Jesus never did miracles to entertain the crowd. The miracles always taught something. And when you read the accounts of the miracles, the people's reaction is real. It's just like we were there. Let me give you an example. Now today we had down here in Florida 6 to 10 feet in waves out there in the surf. Okay? That's pretty good waves out there. I heard the fellas on our staff went down to the beach and they looked at the waves, and I mean they were coming in. I've been in Hawaii where they had the waves up to 20 feet tall coming through when you've had hurricanes and so on, and I've seen those. You don't go swimming in a 20-foot wave, do you? Why? Because if you're going up while this wave is coming and it comes over you, you can have 20 feet of water pushing you right straight down into the gravel and grinding you up down there. It gets pretty hard to come up, and then while you're coming up, then the other wave's coming over right behind that. Remember the account, Matthew, Mark, Luke, all three of them record the account of Jesus and the disciples on the Sea of Galilee. And Jesus is tired, so he goes and rests in the bottom of the ship. And they are sailing across the Sea of Galilee, and the wind comes down off the Golan Heights, and you can have some real waves coming up. In fact, the way the account is written, Peter thought they were going to die. He thought they were going to die. They were bailing for all they're worth. You ever been in a small boat when the waves are filling it up and the wind is blowing like mad and you're losing and you only got these little cans and you're trying to bail out? Well, you know you're in big trouble. You know you're in big trouble. Nothing's going to help you, and pretty soon you're going to be down, and then you're going to be swimming out there in the waves and you don't do a lot of swimming. So Peter, a fisherman, seeing what the score was, got scared, said, "Where's Jesus?" James says, he's out, sacked out, down at the bottom of the boat. What? Tell him, wake him up, get a bucket, let's go, we're going down. So Peter goes running down to Jesus. This is a marginal reading of the Ankerberg translation here, as you understand. Peter goes down, and he says, Jesus, get up. Jesus wakes up, says, "What's the matter?" He says, "The wind, the waves, it's coming into the boat. We're going down. Grab a bucket." So Jesus comes on up to the top. He looks. These huge waves rolling by. Remember Hawaii 5-0? Those of you guys are real old. Remember those waves you used to have on Hawaii 5? See one of those waves coming at you. Peter says, "You see that? It's coming toward us. We're going down. Do something." What does Jesus say? "Oh, ye of little faith." "Yeah, right, Jesus. This wave is coming, you see?" So Jesus turns and he looks at the wave, looks at the wind, looks at the elements, and he says, "Peace, be still." I can just see Peter looking at James. "Did you see that? I mean, now that's going to really help us out here. Peace, be still. I mean..." And while he's saying that, the wind drops off. And as the wind drops off, the waves start to smooth out. And pretty soon, all of a sudden, it's just quiet, and the water is just lapping up against the boat. And Peter and James and the other disciples are absolutely drenched, standing there with their buckets in their hand, looking around. And what I like about all three of the accounts, what Peter said next is exactly what I think we would have said. Peter looks over at James and he says, "Who is this man?" Right? "Who is this guy? Did you just see what happened? Nobody goes around and says to the elements, 'Peace, be still,' and everything stops. He just did. Who is this guy?" And Jesus didn't do it to show off. There's nothing after that. It's just what happened, and that's their reaction. Look, I spoke on the university campuses during the Vietnam War. I had friends that came home in a box. And I can remember one time we went out to a cemetery where one of my friends, 20 years of age, was shot in Vietnam. And there was about three people there, and it was a gloomy day, something like this, except Chicago cold, okay? And it's rainy, and it's drizzly, and it's cold. And here's the dirt's been put into the grave, and you're standing looking at each other, trying to fumble for words to say. And that's a despairing situation. And I thought of, what would it be like if some fella came along and said, "What's the matter with you guys?" You say, "Our friend here, he was in Vietnam, he got shot, he's dead, only 20 years of age." And he says, "Well, hey, don't be so gloomy. You see those shovels over there? Dirt's not too bad. Get the dirt out. Get the shovels, dig the dirt out." "What?" He says, "Trust me, I know what I'm doing." "So you're nuts enough to do it." So you dig down 6 feet, you pile up the dirt 6 feet right next to the grave. You say, "Now what?" He says, "Well, I'll tell you what. You see the casket down there? It looks a little locked. Can you pry the cover loose just a little bit?" And so you pry the cover loose, but he says, "Leave it shut." "Yeah, you want to leave it shut because the body stinks down there." And so then you climb out of the hole and you're standing there and you say, "Well, now, you know, what else are we going to do?" And he says, "Well, I'll tell you what, what's the fella's name?" And you say, "Well, his name is Harry." And so the guy says, "Hey, Harry, come on out of there." And you say, you mean we did all of that work for nothing? I mean, you're just going to talk to this fella? Come on." And while you're saying this and kidding this fella, all of a sudden the cover swings open and Harry sits up in the box. And you're looking down there, and Harry stands up and climbs out of the grave, and he's standing right next to you, and you don't know what to say. "Hey, Harry, how was the trip? What are you going to say?" And this guy that says, "Hey, Harry, come on out of there," he says, "Harry looks a little cold, needs a little food, take care of him," and he starts walking away. Now, you're dumb, but you're not that dumb, and you say, "Hey, look, I'm going to die someday. Where are you going to be? Maybe you could come over and say, 'Hey, Johnny, come on out of there.'" That's what happened at Lazarus' tomb. "Hey, Lazarus, come on out of there." If you had Jesus around and you went to a funeral, you would never know if you were going to come home with the guy you went to see. And we just don't do that. But when Jesus said that, he also taught,
He said, when you see this, then remember, I am the resurrection and the life. He that believeth in me, though you die, yet you will live. Why? Because I am the resurrection. I am life. I'll take care of it. See, that's empirical proof. Want to see this? Then let me teach you something. That's how Jesus did the miracles. But the capper is the fact of his own crucifixion and his resurrection from the dead.
For additional resources, log on to jashow.org. That's jashow.org.